Lecture 41, A Generation of Protests, Civil Rights.
In this lecture, we move from the third world efforts to develop back to the first world. While in the third world, intellectuals struggle to define a path to prosperity, in the first world, intellectuals question the roots of their own prosperity, as well as its limits in promoting truly democratic societies. In the U.S., a generation of intellectuals and other dissidents openly challenge the comfortable assumptions of the Cold War order and its promise to defend democracy at home and abroad. Starting in the mid-1950s and culminating in the late 1960s, a number of political opposition movements argued that something was wrong with the democratic system as it was being practiced in the United States. These political movements had different agendas, but they all agreed that in some way the U.S. had betrayed its democratic foundations, and they called on the country to live up to its lofty rhetoric of equality, free expression, and individual rights. In the next several lectures, we will examine several of these movements. First, the civil rights, then the student movement, and finally, the women's movement. The issues that these movements raised, race, radical democracy, and feminism, continue to be topics of debate within Western and American culture. As a result, however controversial the movements themselves, and they've been both lauded and attacked as movements, they mark a watershed in debates about democracy within Western culture. This movement, this group of movements, is often lumped under the collective umbrella of the 60s, named after the rebellious decade that symbolized the disillusionment many people felt with the path that the United States was taking. The 60s is probably most famous for the student movement that broke out on university campuses, but this was only one part of a multifaceted rebellion that included middle-class women, African Americans, Chicanos, homosexuals. These different groups sometimes overlapped and sometimes not, but their collective disillusionment spawned a decade of protests that shook American confidence to its foundations. The protesters were a minority of the population, but they were numerous and vocal enough to get their demands or their agenda into the public sphere. Similar protests occurred outside of the United States, in Western Europe, especially Paris and Milan, as well as Mexico City, and even in Eastern Europe. But the phenomenon was most prominent in America, because once again, America was the self-proclaimed heir of the democratic tradition. At first glance, it's difficult to understand where this wave of protests came from. In the mid-1950s, all the general indicators would seem to point to stability and quietism in the United States, not revolt. On the one hand, the government had been seemingly successful in deadening political opposition. Remember the McCarthyist era and the Red Scare. So it had deadened political opposition and imposed a certain kind of conformity. On the other hand, the U.S. was embarking on its most sustained period of economic growth in the 20th century. This was the classic era of the American dream, when the combination of unlimited growth and a rapidly expanding consumer society pointed to the possibility of a comfortable middle-class life for everyone. In other words, there was even talk that there would be no lower class anymore. Everyone would enter into the middle class. Everyone would have a car, a television, a house in the suburbs, their two children and their dog. This promise of material prosperity was so great that by the early 1960s, pundits had created the label the affluent society to define the era. So between the Cold War and the affluent society, how did we get a widespread protest movement coming out of this context? For many protesters, the gap between the official image of the American dream and their own experience created a gap that opened up increasing disillusionment. The official image of America, of course, was one of unlimited prosperity and as a bulwark, a democratic bulwark against communism. That was the official image. But for the protesting generation that was coming of age, either democracy or prosperity, or both, were more illusion than reality. So the irony of the 60s generation is that it emerged precisely out of a complacent, self-satisfied, triumphalist generation. In other words, it was precisely the complacent claim that America had reached the pinnacle of capitalist democratic success that provoked opposition from those who felt excluded or dissatisfied in some way with that success. In this way, I think we can compare the 60s generation to the post-World War I generation, which protested against the complacency of the European elite leadership of 1914. Within that framework, each group had its own grievances, but there were two main categories of them. The majority of the protest groups insisted that they had been excluded in some way from the American dream. Thus, blacks, Chicanos, women, and homosexuals argued or complained that they were not being treated as full and equal citizens. So they all demanded in some way that the privileges of American society be spread to groups still marginalized and excluded, whether in political, social, or economic terms. For the students, however, the issue was somewhat different. The students were the sons and daughters of the privileged middle and upper middle class, so for them it wasn't the case of being excluded from the American dream. Their complaint was that the American dream itself, as defined, had become an empty one, that anti-communism and material prosperity were empty goals that had nothing to do with democracy. So the prosperity that their Depression-era parents viewed as such a great achievement was to them, or was dismissed as, a cheap replacement for democratic idealism. So whereas then for the various minority groups, the problem was that the American dream excluded them, for the students, the sons and daughters of privilege, the American dream that they had inherited was seen as an empty goal. But for both, the bottom line was that the image of triumphant prosperity and democracy was in some way an illusion, that America should be forced to live up to her grandiose rhetoric. Within this general context of disillusionment, each movement had its own separate spark that got it going. For students, obviously, it was the Vietnam War. For African Americans, it was the Supreme Court's ruling on Brown versus the Board of Education in 1954. For gays, it was the beatings at a New York City bar called the Stonewall Inn in 1969. But each individual movement contributed to a growing momentum of protest. By the late 1960s, their collective impact was great enough to transform the political culture and the nature of democratic debate, even though they constituted a minority of the population. In this lecture, we'll focus on the Black Civil Rights Movement, which was the most powerful and had the greatest impact of the various minority movements demanding their inclusion in the promise of the American dream. Specifically, the Civil Rights Movement was an attack on a series of discriminatory laws that enforced a kind of apartheid in the southern states, the so-called Jim Crow laws. But in more general terms, the Civil Rights Movement was a demand that the United States confront the ways in which race undermined its democratic rhetoric of equality and set up a de facto double standard of citizenship. So that was the larger demand behind the attack on the Jim Crow laws. The movement began after the Supreme Court's Brown versus the Board of Education ruling in 1954 and culminated in 1965 with the passage of the Voting Rights Act, which ended the campaign for the end of legal discrimination against Black Americans. Why was Brown versus the Board of Education so important in opening up this movement? I think there are two important ways that Brown versus the Board opened this new era. First, it established a legal basis for an attack on the Jim Crow laws. In so doing, it overturned the 1896 Supreme Court ruling of Plessy versus Ferguson that separate but equal was constitutional. The Jim Crow laws essentially, of course, established the fact that as long as you had separate but equal institutions, whether they were drinking fountains or schools, that this was equality and this provided democratic opportunities for everyone. But Brown versus the Board of Education argued that even if conditions in schools were equivalent, quote, to separate children from others of similar age and qualifications solely because of their race generates a feeling of inferiority as to their status in the community that may affect their hearts and minds in a way unlikely ever to be undone, unquote. The ruling concentrated on schools, but it also implied, of course, that other forms of racial segregation, from water fountains to buses, were unconstitutional. So that's the first way in which Brown versus the Board of Education provided an impetus for a popular movement. But there was a second reason as well. That is, the Eisenhower administration and the Congress showed very little interest in enforcing it or implementing it. Furthermore, local officials and Southern politicians resisted the Supreme Court's mandate to move, quote, with all deliberate speed, unquote, towards desegregation. Thus, a group of 19 senators and 82 congressmen issued a statement called the Southern Manifesto in March of 1956, in which it accused the Supreme Court of an abuse of judicial power, that is, of intervening in states' rights, and of destroying the, quote, amicable relations between the white and Negro races, unquote. Thus, what Brown versus the Board of Education does is it establishes a powerful tension between a statement by the Supreme Court that America was not living up to its rhetoric of equality and the combination of indifference or active resistance on the part of government officials to that statement. And it's in that space created by that tension that the civil rights movement arises. A protest against government policy that claimed to speak in the name of true American ideals. In other words, it was a movement launched in the name of democracy against a government that didn't practice democracy. This was a different kind of challenge from fascism and communism, which, of course, were calling for the overthrow of the democratic system. This was what I would call a more fundamentalist movement, that is, trying to reestablish or recall America to its democratic fundamentals. As Martin Luther King wrote in a famous essay in 1963, quote, "One day the South will know that when these disinherited children of God sat down at lunch counters, they were, in reality, standing up for the best in the American dream and the most sacred values in our Judeo-Christian heritage, and thus carrying our whole nation back to the great wells of democracy which were dug deep by the founding fathers in the formulation of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence," unquote. After Brown versus the Board of Education in 1954, the organization of the civil rights movement took shape under the leadership of Dr. Martin Luther King. In 1957, King formed the Southern Christian Leadership Conference to mobilize the black churches behind the push for civil rights. King's leadership also helped determine the shape that movement would take. As a Christian and a follower of Gandhi's ethic of nonviolence, King brought the Gandhian principles of nonviolent resistance to the civil rights movement. As he said, quote, "We must meet the forces of hate with the power of love. We must meet physical force with soul force," unquote. Like the Indian nationalist movement then, the civil rights movement used the suffering of its own people to try to change the hearts of the enemy. Remember Gandhi's words. And like the Indian movement, it claimed to speak in the name of ideals touted by the government that was oppressing it. Similarly, the protesters engaged in mass acts of civil disobedience against laws they considered unjust, but accepting arrest and imprisonment from the government. In other words, Gandhi had defined the only way to pursue civil disobedience as within a context of accepting the legal punishment for breaking those laws. With this legal and organizational base, the civil rights movement brought hundreds of thousands of protesters into the streets, mostly black and some white. The strategy of the movement that takes shape was to target a particular city and a particular type of segregation, and then bring people in from all over the South to make that case more strongly and to increase the pressure. The first major campaign was set off by a 42-year-old seamstress, Rosa Parks, who in Montgomery, Alabama, in December of 1955, made the simple act of refusing to give up her seat on the bus to a white person, as required by Montgomery law. Her arrest sparked the decision by local black leaders to boycott the bus system, and they formed an association called the Montgomery Improvement Association to support the boycott and asked the 26-year-old Baptist minister Martin Luther King to lead the association. For months, blacks refused to ride city buses, and the boycotters organized a complicated system of carpools to move 20,000 people a day to their destinations within the city. The city tried to intimidate the Montgomery Improvement Association through arresting its leaders, including King, and an organization called the White Citizens Council drew 10,000 people to a demonstration in support of continued segregation of the buses. However, the boycott ended up being successful in both economic and political terms. Thus, the bus's company's profits plummeted 65% during the boycott. And in political terms, a federal court struck down Montgomery's segregation ordinances. So in other words, with this campaign, the civil rights movement found both a strategy and a leader. Other important campaigns were the attempt to integrate lunch counters, which began in Greensboro, North Carolina in 1960, and spread to 11 other cities. By the end of 1960, over 70,000 people in over 150 southern cities and towns had participated in sit-ins at lunch counters, demanding service for non-whites. Another campaign began in May of 1961, when seven black and six white freedom riders boarded a bus in Washington, D.C., headed for Alabama and Mississippi, to force desegregation of bus stations. At stops along the way, the riders were attacked by mobs and eventually arrested by police. Hundreds more freedom riders followed until the Interstate Commerce Commission banned segregation in interstate terminals. In the spring of 1963, the movement focused on Birmingham, Alabama, one of the most segregated cities in the South. When Martin Luther King violated a local court injunction prohibiting protest marches, he was arrested and spent the week in jail writing what became his famous letter from the Birmingham jail, where he defended the movement's tactics and its links with the American dream. As he says, quote, "We will reach the goal of freedom in Birmingham and all over the nation because the goal of America is freedom. Abused and scorned though we may be, our destiny is tied up with America's destiny," unquote. Unfortunately, not all Southerners agreed. And the resistance, both unofficial and official, to desegregation was passionate and sometimes violent. When desegregation of Central High School in Little Rock, Alabama, was scheduled to begin in September of 1957, the governor called in the National Guard, which turned back the nine black students with bayonets. And when James Meredith tried to become the first black to enroll at the all-white University of Mississippi, the governor of that state personally prevented his registration in September of 1962 and vowed that he would go to jail before allowing blacks at Ole Miss. On the popular level, Ku Klux Klan membership skyrocketed, as did their lynchings and beatings of black activists. Tens of thousands more joined angry mobs that yelled epithets at young black children trying to attend school. Local authorities ordered police to turn water hoses on children and release attack dogs against peaceful protesters. If there had been any doubt, this unabashedly violent reaction to the peaceful demands for integration demonstrated how far America was from the reality of a harmonious democratic society. And what made this more than a local issue was that these images were being transmitted nightly again on national television, so that people all over the United States were watching police turn water hoses on children. It was this specter of violent resistance and the way it pushed itself into the national consciousness through television that finally forced the federal government to get involved by sending in troops. A reluctant President Eisenhower was the first to respond in 1957 to the violence surrounding the integration of Central High in Little Rock, Arkansas, when he said, quote, that failure to respond would be tantamount to acquiescence in anarchy and the dissolution of the Union, unquote. Then in 1962, President Kennedy sent federal marshals in to protect James Meredith when he was trying to register at the University of Mississippi. And when a mob killed two of those federal marshals, Kennedy then sent in 30,000 troops. After years of local boycotts and protests, the civil rights movement exploded into national politics in August of 1963 with the March on Washington, which was staged to build support for civil rights legislation at the national level. 250,000 people gathered in Washington, D.C. at the Lincoln Memorial in the largest civil rights demonstration in American history, in which Martin Luther King gave his most famous I Have a Dream speech. The march raised a number of issues, but focused on the need to get black Americans on the voting lists. And it was this campaign that occupied the civil rights movement in 1964 and 1965. Blacks were theoretically allowed to vote, but southern states used all sorts of means to prevent them from voting, giving literacy tests, charging poll taxes, publishing the names of blacks who registered to vote so that they could be harassed by the Ku Klux Klan. The result of all these measures was that, for example, in a state like Arkansas, although the black population was 50% of Arkansas's population, it only made up 1% of its voters. Likewise, in Mississippi, only 5% of eligible black voters were on the voting list. In general, throughout the South, only 2 million of the 5 million adult blacks were registered to vote. Volunteers from within the civil rights movement tried to register blacks to vote, culminating with a 54-mile march from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama, to ask Governor George Wallace's protection for blacks who were registering to vote. Instead, of course, under Wallace's orders, police turned back the marchers with bullwhips, and once again, the image of violence catalyzed the federal administration, under President Johnson this time, to act in proposing the Voting Rights Act, which was passed in 1965 and which outlawed all of the obstacles to registering blacks to vote, and which actually sent in federal registrars to get blacks on the voting list. With the Voting Rights Act came the end of the civil rights movement, that is, the end of the movement dedicated to the passage of anti-discriminatory legislation. But the contradictions of racial discrimination could not be solved so easily. Thus, it was ironic that only 5 days after the passage of the Voting Rights Act, the Watts section of Los Angeles exploded in a week of looting and burning, in which black residents largely trashed their own neighborhoods in an expression of rage that left 34 people dead. This riot set off a train of urban riots, the so-called long hot summers of the next few years in northern and midwestern cities. Parts of the country that had been watching the civil rights movement with a kind of righteous indignation, not really looking at the problems that race had created in their own northern societies. In these urban riots, the calls were not for civil rights, but for economic justice, for jobs and housing. In cities like Detroit and Newark, black unemployment was twice as high as that of whites, and almost 42% of urban blacks lived below the poverty level. Johnson's advisory commission, which he set up to study where the riots had come from, warned that, quote, our nation is moving towards two societies, one black and one white, separate and unequal, unquote. If the civil rights movement demonstrated the limits of American democracy, the urban riots demonstrated the limits of American prosperity. In other words, of that highly touted affluent society. In these urban ghettos, you could see the limits of that vision of a kind of universal middle class. The urban riots created a crisis in black leadership and propelled an alternate vision of black empowerment with greater appeal for the poor urban blacks of these northern cities. Stokely Carmichael developed a message of black power derived from Malcolm X's alternative vision of black nationalism and separatism. Instead of fighting for integration, which of course was the message of the civil rights movement, Malcolm X argued that blacks shouldn't be trying to integrate into a corrupt system, but a real revolution should create separate black states and economic self-sufficiency. In many ways, Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, both of course assassinated for their beliefs, represent two major strands of the struggle against racism in the United States. One strand, which goes back to Marcus Garvey, who in the 1920s urged blacks to reject all white culture, and the other strand that goes back to W.E.B. Du Bois, who pushed for integration and equal rights in the early 20th century. So you have those two strands of black mobilization in the 20th century, which culminate with King and Malcolm X. While both the civil rights and the black power movements forced the issue of race and American democracy into the open and made it a national issue, the contradictions of racial discrimination and a two-tiered society were not resolved in the 1960s. Since the 1960s, Americans continued to have strong disagreements about the degree to which race undermines democratic practice in the U.S. Some would see that major progress has been made towards a colorblind society in which all citizens are truly equal. But others insist that racial difference still forms one of the central cleavages in American society. This ongoing disagreement tends to erupt. In other words, it's a simmering disagreement which tends to erupt to the surface at moments of crisis, whether it was the O.J. Simpson trial, which revealed dramatic gaps between black and white opinions about the fairness of the justice system, or the vigorous debate about affirmative action that has been reopened with the passage of California's anti-affirmative action proposition in the 1990s, and which has opened an enormous debate about whether affirmative action is the best way to achieve democratic equality, or whether it's now actually undermining democratic equality by favoring certain groups. In addition, debates and anxieties over immigration have raised similar issues about whether American democracy can and should continue to strive for a nation of equals in a sea of difference.